The following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD, specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray. Please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
If it were possible, I would offer every moment, every word, every thought. But my memory is too faulty for total recall. Instead, I will show a sequence of events, some in order, some not. And somewhere along the way, I may discover just what it was that happened to me.
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me this week is our man Friday, the big cheese behind the Psychotronic Netflix group on Facebook. Special guest, Paul Freitag.
Thank you, Mike. I really appreciate the chance to talk about this great little movie.
Of course. This week we're looking at The Woman Chaser, the freshman film from director Robinson DeVore, based on the 1960 Charles Williford novel of the same name, though Williford's original title was The Director, which is far more appropriate since there's very little women chasing going on and a lot more movie making. It's the story of Richard Hudson, a used car salesman who finds his life is missing some kind of creative outlet. Being in the land of dreams, he decides to make a movie, and not just any movie, the best movie ever created. It's called The Man Who Got Away, and it's the simple story of a truck driver who runs over a little girl and the wrath society inflicts on him. Outside of this movie, within a movie, we see Hudson writing a script, getting his funding, and choosing his actors. The film ends up being a tour de force. The only problem is that it doesn't run long enough for the studio. It's 63 minutes long. Hudson's solution to the studio's problem is, let's say, it's a little extreme. So, Paul, tell me, what's your history with Charles Williford?
Well, I went through a little bit of a Williford phase while I was reading a lot of pulp crime books in kind of the mid-90s. I'd read my fair share of, like, Jim Thompson and the like, and started reading Williford when I found this kind of raidy-ass mass-market version of Cockfighter. I read a couple of his books, Pickup and Miami Blues, after that. I hadn't read The Woman Chaser until after I'd seen the movie, which I rented from a Hollywood Video, which is the only place that it was available. I saw it and fell in love with it, bought the book and read that, waited until Hollywood started getting rid of their copies so I could pick up a couple for the video store I was managing at the time.
Yeah, it was strange that it was just in the one store.
Yeah.
At least the cover was very eye-catching, that kind of pulpy-looking thing to it. Mm. I'm glad that you even saw the video sitting on the shelf, because they certainly weren't marketing it very well.
Live in Chicago, and it had played at the Music Box Theater here, but the distribution of it was basically nothing. So I was very fortunate to just happen to notice it at Hollywood and pick it up and add it to my store's collection.
So for folks listening at home, we should probably talk a little bit more about who Williford is, what Williford is. His writing is, I love it. I think it's some of the most well thought out, very articulate. He had a real love of language, and he knew how to play with it, knew how to play with points of view. I mean, I love in The Woman Chaser that the narrator, Richard Hudson himself, is having troubles writing in third person. He wants to keep writing in first person. And the way that the whole book is written, kind of like a script, mm-hmm. You know? Miami Blues is probably Williford's best known work, which is kind of a shame because that was one of his last novels. I mean, he really kind of got the attention he deserved really late in life. He wrote Miami Blues. Lewes, and then he wrote three other Hoak Mosely novels. Hoak Mosely was the main character in those. And I want to say that he passed either right before or right after Miami Blues the movie came out. So he really, unfortunately, didn't have the career afterwards that he really should have. But he had had such a great career beforehand. You had mentioned Cockfighter, which again was turned into a movie. And there's a great book that Williford wrote called The Cockfighter Journal, which was his whole story behind the making of the movie, which unfortunately isn't that easy to find. And that's the problem with a lot of these Williford books is for a long time, they were super difficult to find. I mean, you're pretty lucky if you could find one in a used bookstore. Now, here and there, they come out every few years. It seems like somebody releases another version of, you know, they pick an older title and they re-release it. I think like Black Mass of Brother Springer finally came out, which I want to say that one was called Honey Gal at one time. You know, and that was the other problem, too, is he had so many different titles for his stuff. It seemed like every book had at least two titles, if not more. So you never knew if you had picked it up before or what was going on. So Black Lizard put out a couple of them, which was good.
Right, right. Yeah, I think Pick Up, the one that I'd read, was on Black Lizard.
Yeah, Pick Up. I'm not sure. Did you like that one?
I liked it, though it's probably been... you know, 15 years since I've read it.
Right.
So I can't remember all that much about it.
I think I started off with Williford either with Miami Blues or it might have been The High Priest of California, Wild Wives, like double release that V-Vales company that did research, they put out forever ago.
Okay.
Which is neat because High Priest of California has Russell Haxby is the main character's name, kind of, you know, the R.H. Richard Hudson, and he's a used car salesman again. Mm. So it's kind of a good precursor. You know, Williford was not afraid to take his ideas and kind of recycle himself. He would do a great job of kind of putting one thing in a book and then being like, you know, I want to mess with that idea and blow that out into a whole other thing. So he did a really good job with that. I have to say Cockfighter is pretty much stands alone as far as he's never had another mute character or, mm-hmm. you know, mute by choice character.
Yeah, right, right.
No more cockfighting and stuff, though he did have a chicken in one of the stories in the Machine in Ward 11, if memory serves. I can't remember the name of the technique where you use a chicken to predict the future, but he had a story about that. So.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, good stuff. The Richard Hudson name was used again in a book called Understudy for Love, which I keep hoping was going to be re-released one of these days. I know for a while, Dennis McMillan, who has released a bunch of Williford stuff, he talked about releasing that as Understudy for Death. And it's the story of this reporter who gets involved with all this kind of stuff. And it's kind of, you know, the understudy part comes in because he is a actor at a local community theater, which also Williford was involved with local community theater as well. So you kind of get that whole play of plays and scripts and all this kind of stuff. I mean, when he did Cockfighter, one of the provisions when he worked with Roger Corman was that he got to write the screenplay because he had always wanted to write a screenplay before. And it was one of these, like, how difficult is that? And mm-hmm. it sounded very, very Richard Hudson-esque. You know? So what were your initial thoughts when you read The Woman Chaser the first time?
Well, I'd already seen the movie, so I kind mm-hmm. of had this predisposed image as to, I was already picturing Patrick Warburton in the part as I read it.
Right.
So I was kind of had that in my mind already. I really like the book. It's very dark. It's kind of like an inspirational sociopath story. It's like I kind of thought of it as like a fountainhead for psychotics, where it's just like this guy who just wants to create, and he's not going to let anybody or any situation tell him that his creation is not working or that his creation isn't going to be seen by other people. It just treads this line between sinister and mean-spirited and darkly comic so well that I couldn't help falling in love with both the movie and the book.
I'm glad to be talking to you since you saw the movie first and then read the book, because I was just the opposite. But I was very surprised when I went in and saw the movie and just how faithful it was to the book. I mean, I know you went back and you reread the book recently, mm-hmm. this week even. I'm trying to remember some of the differences, but a lot of them have just been kind of glossed over because the movie seems to capture so much so well for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the differences between the book and the film are so so minor, they're almost trivial. There's just a few differences in terms of character relations, and they kind of skip through a few things just for the sake of pacing. But for the most part, it nails the spirit and plotting of the book exactly.
And yeah, I think you're totally right when you say sociopath, too, because I think a lot of Williford's characters are complete sociopaths and a little bit sadistic as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he just had awesome sociopaths in almost all of his books, and they were just so interesting. And it's strange how much of their inner dialogue and their attitudes, by their, I'm meaning the characters, comes through in Williford's own work, his autobiographical work, because he had done, I think he wrote 2 autobiographies plus a couple autobiographical stories, and then a lot of his stuff kind of worked its way into the book. So hopefully he wasn't like that in real life and he got it out through his novels. Mm-hmm. Hudson was just, he had some issues. I like that it starts off with the used car lot. He grabs you right from the beginning when he has the character out there counting the cars going northbound and southbound. Mm-hmm. And just, he gets me with the one line where he says, this was the day I was going to steal a used car lot. And it's like, okay. And yeah, they were really smart. And then even in the book, how he says, like, that was a flashback and that got your attention. Now I'm going to bring you into this. And again, you know, Williford was so into writing and the mechanics of writing that he really kind of was pulling back the curtain a little bit and saying, you know, this is what I'm doing, you know, even though it was through the voice of Richard Hudson saying, this is what I'm doing. Now I'm going to do this. Now I'm, you know, and just kind of telling you throughout why he is doing these things and manipulating you the whole time.
Right, right. And saying, you know, these things may not be in the correct chronological order. And even at certain points, just going into script form.
Right.
For the book, which must have made it very easy to adapt. But yeah, he plays so much with just the literary form that you kind of can't help but being swept away by it.
Right, exactly. We're going to take a break for a minute, and we will be back after a few words from our sponsors. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today. Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com. A little bit of Chico O'Farrell's Fiesta Time, one of the few dozen songs that make up the Woman Chaser's lush soundtrack. We'll hear director Robinson DeVore talking about that a little bit more later. But now let's talk about the film itself. What were your impressions? I know I asked you about your impressions of the book the first time you read it, but how was it coming in and seeing that video the first time?
I didn't really know what to expect going into it because I kind of had heard a little bit about it. I knew Williford's writing, but I hadn't known this particular piece. I went in, and it's this black and white kind of, not really a neo-noir, but it's very, I hesitate to say tongue-in-cheek, but it's this kind of very deadpan style in terms of watching this character who is insanely committed to everything that he wants to do, yet at the same time kind of bored with what he's been doing and just wants to go on to another project. Just watching Patrick Warburton go through the paces of being this sociopathic character is just so fun to watch. And the rest of the cast is just amazing as well. And from what I understand, they're using mostly non-actors in most of the roles. It works out amazingly because I couldn't even tell that they were non-actors because they're just so natural in what they're doing. And that's one of the points that I think they make in the book, where they talk about how they want to cast non-actors in all of these roles in the movie within the book or the movie within the movie, because they don't want people to be taken out of the film and have that baggage of having their previous roles attached to them.
Right. I know that some of the people that have gone were in that movie have done other things, and some have gone on to do other things since then. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there were so many actors where I'm just like, don't know this person. They're very fascinating to look at. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got those great faces and stuff. The guy who played the main actor in The Man Who Got Away, I know I've seen him before, but not enough where it's like, oh, you know, I expect him to be this person and act this way.
Like, there's so many scenes that are taken verbatim from the book.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, at one point in the book, Hudson talks about how a director inflicts his own vision on the writer's work and that ruins it, which seems to be exactly what DeVore is trying to avoid. Exactly. I mean, we lose a few things here and there, like the scene where there's the lead actress is cast in the grocery store, and we kind of skip through the creating of the movie itself, but it's more in service of pacing than in anything. It doesn't really affect the tone. So
yeah, it's tough for me to believe that this is DeVore's first film. Yeah. My God. I mean, it looks gorgeous. The cinematography is terrific, and just the composition is wonderful in so many of these.
It is a beautiful movie to watch. It's kind of demanding a DVD release, and I'm rather upset that it has not gotten one yet, but
yep. My other favorite scene, just because it's so crazy, but again, it's right from the book, is him dancing with his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole, you know, I think the music is different. I think it's Bartok, you know, because Wilford always would write about Bartok in his books. But other than the musical choice for that one particular scene, I think that's almost exactly like that. And for me, that's the moment when everything changes. He seems to transform from the used car salesman into the director in that scene where he just, you know, he needs to get all this stuff out of his system, and he's there doing all these jumps and stuff. I mean, it's so funny to watch Warburton in that scene, especially holding his arms back and running across the room.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and Warburton, I mean, I had only really seen him before this, before The Woman Chaser. I'd only seen him in Seinfeld, and he was very limited in Seinfeld, you know, on purpose, obviously, you know, just kind of squinting at the world and walking through it like he didn't want to know what was going on. And in this one, you know, he had that same squint and stuff, but he had a much better range in this, and his voiceover I thought was pitch perfect.
Mm-hmm. Because Warburton, especially now, seems to have kind of found his calling in doing a lot of voiceover work, because mm-hmm. he's got such an amazing voice that you know, you're watching Venture Brothers or Family Guy, and it's just this booming, awesome Patrick Warburton voice that you can't not love. He's perfect in this. I mean, the only other person I could imagine seeing this part is like a young Sterling Hayden.
Right.
Who obviously would have been too old even by the time the book was written. But he has that that kind of perfect pitch where it's not quite satirical, and he's not making fun of it, but it's like he's just embracing kind of the ridiculousness of his character. And I really love that.
Yeah, he seems to believe every word that he's saying, mm-hmm. you know, and no matter how crazy it is, he's just right there and taking us along with him, which mm-hmm. is great. It's funny, though, how well he plays comedy. And I think that's probably one of the things that really damned this movie a little bit. People didn't know whether to laugh or not. Me, I laughed and I got into it. I really, you know, I just sucked it up. I just took it for what it was. And I know that they, you know, we'll be hearing in a little bit when we talk to Robinson DeVore and Joe McSpadden, the producer, that they had a lot of problems with the reviews of the films, or at least one review, because just didn't get it. But
I can see, I've shown this to a few people, and some of them either get it and love it, and some of them are just, they just sit through it stone-faced and, like, have no idea how to take it. Right. So it's may not be for everybody's taste, but it's like, you'll know within the first 5 minutes if you're going to get it or not. So. Right.
They kept a lot of scenes where there are times when you're watching it, you're just like, I don't really know why this scene is in here, but for me, I enjoy it. Like the scene of the young Richard Hudson at the pool with the woman who thinks that they're the same age. And then when she finds out that he's a kid, it just like ends his childhood basically. Or the part where he's talking about leading a moth out of a house and turning on the lights and stuff. And it's so poetic and it's so beautiful and it's shot so well. But there are times where I'm like, I guess they could leave that out. But for me, I wanted to see it. It was really good to see.
The pool scene with the young Richard Hudson is in there in order to justify the title, because he doesn't really do any woman chasing.
No.
At all during the course of the book or the movie.
No.
He's pursued occasionally, and you know, he manages to get his fair share of action, but he doesn't really do any chasing. So.
That's the other thing too, when he sleeps with his stepsister and he basically ruins her for right. It's so wrong, but so funny.
As unpleasant and unromantic as he possibly can.
Just like, she'll never mess around with boys now. Oh, that's so good. And then when he and his secretary from the studio are on the beach and they're sniffing her panties. And his line after that about, you know, when a man starts doing things like this.
He's pretty much only having sex like out of desperation, out of like he feels the need to, not out of any kind of desire to. It's just like, eh, this is something to do. I can have some sort of power play here, especially with the Salvation Army
blow shot. Yeah, that's pretty much the only woman that he really goes after.
Right. Yeah.
Which is a nice framing device too. You know, that's different than the book, but yeah, really that works out very well, because that's kind of his nadir at that point. Right before the boom falls on him. So, all right. So I talked about Joe McSpadden and Robinson DeVore. Let's go ahead and we're going to play back interviews with those guys and with star Patrick Warburton. Enjoy.
I want to know how this came about to be your first project.
I was living in Los Angeles after college. I did get a BA in film at Southern Methodist University.
Director Robinson DeVore.
I went down to Texas and I went out to LA, and I really was trying to do different things in my early 20s. I did a half an hour documentary on Angeline. She's a Billboard queen, and that was kind of my first. It was a half hour film. I worked with a great director, Michael Guccione. He's kind of an avant-garde filmmaker in LA who's brilliant, and he gave me the opportunity to co-direct with him. Taught me a lot, and so I had a couple of years to try to figure out, you know, what I would do as a first feature. You know, I was looking at different things. I lived in Africa for a year. I was thinking about trying to do a Hemingway adaptation of The Short Happy Life of Francis McComber, and that fell through, and blah, blah, blah. I always went to the used bookstores. My mindset was, I'm not a good enough screenwriter to write something on my own, and I felt that with a little hunting, I could find something that other people had not found that might be exciting. So I was always in used bookstores in L.A., and one of the books that I found was actually a recent reprint of The Woman Chaser. Somebody had recently published it in the last, you know, 5 years before the film, so it was out there. You know, Wilford, he was kind of in vogue because Miami Blues had been made, and then I'd heard that Robert Redford had optioned a ton of other earlier, you know, books, pre-Hoke Mosley books of Wilford. I think The Woman Chaser was probably seen as being just too absurd, and Harry Dean Stanton wanted to make it for a long time, which is kind of a beautiful thing. He wanted to play the lead, and I think he'd optioned it for a little while. So it was out there. You know, I optioned it 3 years in a row trying to get the money to make it. And I was in my third year, and I was getting a little panicked that I couldn't raise the money. You know, the book is written like a Swiss watch. It's perfectly constructed. The adaptation was easy. I think the script, you know, was fun to read. I was a first-time director, and so luckily there were some people who decided to put some money in, and we got the ball rolling.
How did you get Patrick Warburton?
Rosemary Weldon was our casting director, and I had in my head that Jason Patrick would be an interesting Richard Hudson. Of course, he would have been a lot more, I think, darker and pretty ferocious, and he's a great actor. He was pretty hot at the time, and he probably still is hot. He's a great actor. They weren't really taking, you know, I don't think, my project very seriously. But his manager also represented Patrick Warburton. So being a good manager, they kind of looked into their own galaxy and suggested Patrick. Patrick came in, and he auditioned, and it was really great working with Patrick. You know, Patrick, besides being a phenomenal human being and making it so easy on a first-time director and giving me all the respect in the world and just the most pleasant experience to work with an actor. We had a really nice time figuring out Richard Hudson because, you know, Patrick came in and he's got a great comic sensibility. And you know, I think he was playing him a little bit over the top and a little overzealously just in terms of comedy. And we just had a nice powwow together and we decided that the key was that Richard Hudson had to be very sincere. You know, we had to commit to the idea that he was helping people even when it was clear he was, you know, harming them and destroying them, because he always has a way to kind of justify that stuff. So once we got that going, I think we were off to the races, you know, how to bring him to life.
You know, you said the word absurd earlier, and he brings that kind of absurdism to the fore. He is looking askance at the whole world. I mean, you've got him in sunglasses half the time, too, which is interesting as well.
It's in the book. It's in the book.
Actor Patrick Warburton.
I remember when I first got the script, I wasn't familiar with Charles Williford. It was interesting meeting Rob. I recalled, when I first met him, he didn't have any idea who I was. This was after the ninth season of Seinfeld. Most folks were watching it. Even a few of those who hadn't, you know, religiously watched it even before the ninth season, because Jerry had announced that that was going to be the final season. And at the time, I remember thinking it was probably, a blessing, because seeing Putty, he only knew me from that. He probably wouldn't have said, this is the guy to play Richard Hudson. But Rob strikes me as always, you know, struck me as a guy with great creativity and imagination, so it might not have hindered his choice.
What was it that appealed to you about Richard Hudson?
Primarily, a departure. It was something very different. I love the odd humor, the non-obvious humor. You know, I felt like Rob and I were on the same page in that. You would attack the story, you'd be vigilant and being true to the story, and that the humor would find itself in the absurdity and the audacity and the in behavior and in perception of this character. There you would find the humor. You never go for it, never trying to be funny. That the humor would come out of something more earnestness in the creative process. There were never any trust issues. You could tell right off the bat that this is a guy who's, you got the sense that this guy doesn't do anything half-assed. He's 100%. This is a guy who's, you know, studied the shots. He's, you know, he knows the scene. He knows the essence of the story. He knows how he wants to tell it, you know, visually. He's done his homework. So there's never any trust issue. Right off the bat, you're in good hands.
Executive producer Joe McSpadden.
Rob and I knew each other from both high school and from college, and we were both in Los Angeles and Hollywood, you know, working in different areas. I was working for a producer at the Warner Brothers. Rob was developing projects, and he got a hold of the book, and he adapted it, and he got Patrick Warburton attached. And Patrick was coming off Seinfeld. He was very popular. He was, you know, I don't know if you've noticed, you know, he's now the spokesman for Honda, but back then he was hot doing, I think he was doing M&M's, he was doing Cadillac, and he was doing, there was one other. But anyway, he was very much in the public eye, and it seemed like a great combination. And so that's when Rob brought me the project, brought me the package, and I essentially said, hey, let's give this a try. And so I came up with The budget at that point was close to, I don't know, it was a moving target. It was $350,000, and I think we ended up realistically being right at under $900,000. That figure was to get the first print, and then all the changes and all the travel and all the festivals was above that. So we ended up spending about $1.2 million at the end of the day. And most of that was essentially raised from family and friends. I mean, the story of the Woman Chaser was made at the New York Film Festival's Monday press screening. On Tuesday, we came out with a rave review in the New York Post. And on Thursday, the Friday before our world premiere, the New York Times killed us. Stephen Holden, you know, he didn't like the movie. And once that happened, all the major labels who had been tracking us, because we were the belle of the ball at 99 New York, because we were the only American film that did not that went there without distribution, they all disappeared. I mean, literally overnight.
That was a rough one. That was, you know, that was quite an experience to be selected, certainly out of nowhere. And it was a great year for American filmmakers that were there. And, you know, we just got destroyed by the New York Times, and that just really hurt us. But, you know, that's the way the cookie crumbles. I mean, it was highs and lows, you know, the whole time for that experience.
You know, if I ever meet Stephen Holden, you know, I'm going to go through it with him, because he did cost us $1 million. There's no question about that. That, and although I it would be sort of hard to reconstruct this, but we played in Chicago at the Music Box, and we sent prints for Roger Ebert. And he ended up not reviewing the movie, but on the week that he did, he had an impassioned plea on his program about ostracizing critics who at festivals give bad reviews to films that don't have distribution. And if he wasn't talking about The Woman Chaser, I'll be damned.
It did really well, except for that New York Times. Stephen Holden, who I've never, ever mentioned in any press or anything, you know, he's entitled to his opinion. I thought he was a bit harsh. He might have, you know, missed some things about the film, but he didn't like it. But beyond that, you know, we played across the country in landmark theaters, did good business in L.A. and San Francisco and, you know, Seattle and Chicago and other places like that.
We were basically in 9 cities. You know, we were in L.A., New York, Chicago, Miami, Austin, San Antonio, very odd small markets.
Well, it's good that you're in Miami.
We went to the Florida Film Festival in Orlando, and we had a very good experience and good reviews. We were in Miami, and I think we got good reviews. And a lot of that is, I'm glad, you know, I still keep in touch with Betsy Williford. She is a pistol and a great lady. You know, it was always good to, you know, be in her backyard and make her proud.
So I would have to say, you know, there's a lot of positive press about the movie, but, you know, it didn't do a ton of business. It played on cable and played a few things overseas. I don't think you can call it a success, frankly, in this very harsh business of ours, but it was a success in terms of going as far as it did and being what it was and being a solid film and having good performances and having good artistic qualities and great source material behind it. And I think it was a success of a film, don't get me wrong, but I think commercially it would not have been considered a success.
I hate to sound like the bitter producer crying over spilt milk, you know, 11 years later. Our producer's rep at the time was a guy named Bob Burney. And if you follow independent film and film distribution, you know that guy's a superstar. We are the only film of his that did not succeed. When he left our film, he went to Memento. Then he went to My Big Fat Greek Wedding. Then he did The Passion of the Christ. We found him because I was connected to a lit agent who had a client that had a tough film. And Bob was the one who cobbled together the foreign distribution that the investors got their money back. And Bob is his wife is a huge PR maven. She works for Shandwick, the Rogers and Cowan, and she's was and is still a huge marketing maven. And now he runs Film District. So again, my point is, we were the biggest little movie out there. We had great press. We had great publicity, I should say. We had, for the most part, great reviews. I mean, if you look back on the internet and IMDb, the trade papers were cool to us, and the New York Times was horrible to us. But just about everybody else had something nice to say,
and right.
Whether it was about the direction, the cinematography, or Patrick's performance. And those people who were knowledgeable about Williford realized what a great job we had done,
mm-hmm.
You know, that we had been true to the spirit of Williford. I'm very proud to be part of the Charles Williford legacy.
Were you afraid as a first-time filmmaker making a movie about a failed first-time filmmaker?
You know, I really wasn't. Honestly, you know, that probably shows what kind of blinders I had on about, you know, who I was and who I am. I didn't think about it that way. I was so happy to be working with Charles Williford's material. That is the highest honor. And so I don't care what story parallels there were. I was just fortunate to have that source material. And I was completely happy and completely, you know, as confident as I could be just about what I had to work with, you know.
Now, when it was it released both color and black and white?
Yeah, we shot in color. And, you know, we lit for black and white, so it was a high contrast, a high key lighting, so that there would be, you know, bright whites and dark blacks. They were lighting for black and white and shooting on color stock is essentially what they were doing.
The color version, it seems to run, the pacing seems better. You know, sometimes the black and white, you know, the pacing of the movie was always meant to be very deliberate. But the color version rolls a little faster for some reason. That's a very personal, subjective thing. Rob would probably be horrified to hear that.
At least it looks, you know, you shot it in color and sapped it out. You know, there are so many films where if you do that, it just doesn't look right when it's
right.
Black and white.
Well, that's one thing I can tell you is that our lab in Burbank, Photochem, and the guy who's our, you know, our rep, he's still there. He's now the manager. Nobody had ever done what we did there. We were one of his problem children going through that process and the different stocks and the different processes to get it from essentially a color shot on color stock and then released on in black and white initially. Theatrically it was only black and white and it was color for the international release. We only had made one deal. It was sold in Thailand. It seemed like Rob messed around with it. And this was another thing. We spent a lot of money in that whole process of the, you know, the black and white to color, whether it was the film negative or the telecine process. And there was one that he used to call the hand-colored postcard version.
You know, it's funny. This is like an archetypal Hollywood failed story. Producer's like, look, we're going to make a deal for this thing. You've had your way the whole time, and like we're just going to do it the way we want to do it, and that's just the way it is. So they were like, we're going to release it in full-blown color. We had done a color pass that was very kind of like hand-tinted, you know, like very desaturated postcard-y, which I thought was very pretty. And then they released it, quote-unquote, in Europe, or they sold it to something, you know, with a new title, and the new title was The Art of Insanity. I always had to laugh at that.
Yeah.
I had my way with everything, and frankly, it was a good title to people who were working on it, and frankly, they had to sell the movie, so, you know, I can laugh at it privately. They did what they had to do, man. It was, you know, movies cost money, and, you know, that movie cost money, too.
And if I'm not mistaken, the VHS that, you know, exists out in the Hollywood video, and now defunct Hollywood video chain that used to sit in their bargain barrels was the slightly colored version.
It's so beautiful to look at. I mean, especially like the scene with Hudson running through that field and the little girl and how they pause and do that pose in front of the truck. I mean, it's just beautiful.
Oh, wow. Thanks very much. You know, I tell you, it was a 7-week shoot. And, you know, I've never done, I mean, that's really part of it, man. I've done two other features since then, and they've both been 7-week shoots. And it's a luxury to have time to work on shots. And, you know, like that's the thing in the field. And just, you know, and to travel to locations, it takes a bit of extravagance, you know, especially as I was a first time filmmaker. It took some time and some cobbling it together. You know, we'd go down for a week and go up and go down for 3 weeks, go up for a week. But thank you. Yeah, it's beautiful. Kramer Morgenthau, awesome cinematographer. He's gone on to do big studio work. He was one of 7 cinematographers on that film, though, I must say, which was really interesting because I just was like, people would come and go because we would go down and go back up. And some days there'd be like some Italian cinematographer who was a total gentleman who I had never heard of, never spoken to since. They arranged for him to be on set, and we'd run with that. You learn how to improvise, which is a great thing.
I was going to ask you what kind of lessons you learned on this film that you've been able to apply to your other ones, and that sounds like probably one of the biggest ones.
The other two films that I've made, Police Beat and Zoo, you know, they were much more, I think, experimental and dare I say, even very loose in terms of scripts and almost no scripts. The Woman Chaser, you know, I had 3 years to storyboard to thinking about it in my mind to work out what it meant to, you know, shoot scenes and try to become a director. And so it was very formal. I was always sketching, and I was always, you know, trying to understand what, you know, how to shoot a scene. And The Woman Chaser was definitely a, you know, a living, breathing primer on how to direct for me. I learned so much. You know, I learned there are no wrong angles, and that there's no, you know, I frequently tangled with an AC on that who had some distaste for some of my shots. And my cinematographer would always tell me, absolutely not. You know, you do what you want to do. Don't listen to that. You can do whatever you want and have confidence and see it the way you see it. I'm very lucky. You know, I had a cinematographer who gave me a lot of confidence, and I had an actor who was a great pal and who really was listening and collaborating, and it was just fantastic. I mean, as far as gentlemen, you know, on the set that were my collaborators, they were just awesome.
Warburton seems absolutely fearless in that film. Him dancing with his mother and stuff, oh my God, that's another killer scene. But I have to say, my favorite shot in the whole film is when he's got the musician there, and you've got the truck coming right towards the musician, and he's just playing away on that guitar. I love that.
Yeah, that was a little simple green screen action, but thank you. That was a fun scene. I don't, you know, it really was an interesting. It was kind of, you know, I mean, it was a B movie, and it was, you know, an homage to B movies, and boy, I remember we danced around to a lot of different kind of third tier studio, not even studio, but like, you know, like quote unquote sound stages. And I remember that sound stage, you know, there wasn't much to do there. There was really little room for imagination. So, you know, we just had to work with the bare bones a lot of times. You know, like, I don't know if you remember the editing suite, you know, we were just in some like college or something. It was like some science lecturing room. And we just C-standed up a bunch of celluloid hanging all around this guy, and it was kind of hilarious because it was like, you know, basically a place that they were, you know, lecturing about physics or something. So it was that kind of shoot, you know. It was a beautiful cast of characters. I really, yeah, thank you. Paul Malevich, who plays Leo, you know, Richard's stepfather, who betrays him, you know, he was a non-actor. I was volunteering for a suicide prevention center in Los Angeles, and Paul used to sit next to me, you know, in the graveyard shift, trying to get people to, you know, not shoot themselves in the head. And he was a sweet guy, and you know, he let me hoodwink him into acting in the film. So there are some cool people that, you know, were not actual actors in that too.
Well, I never would have guessed that he wasn't a real actor.
He was really natural, you know, he was just himself in a stiff way, but that was worked for the part, I thought.
Yeah, totally. I mean, he's just always so matter of fact with Richard that it worked. Yeah.
What was it like working with so many non-professional actors on this film?
They were all amazing. They ended up being really good, you know, like Paul. If I run into him again, he'll probably be upset I mentioned this. But I remember, you know, one time his wife showing up on the set with her purse, almost beating him off the set, saying, "You have to go to work." "But dear, we're filming a movie." This poor guy, you know, he couldn't go to a premiere at the New York Film Festival because, you know, he had to work his midnight dispatch. I mean, I think, look, not to take anything away from Paul, Rob knew how to direct somebody, whether they were an actor or not, you know? You know, he had his own approach. Now, there are times, like, you know, I have to say that he was a real pain in the ass to work with because, first off, we're working long hours. None of us are getting paid a dime, and we're working long hours. And he has an idea. Of course, you know, an actor's going to bring what he or her wants to bring to the table and is going to strive to do that, whether or not that's specifically what that director sees and the director does too. You have to meet somewhere in the middle ground. I felt, you know, Rob and I did meet somewhere in the middle ground. But Rob had a real specific vision, and he stuck to it. I was able to appreciate, I mean, look, we had a good time working together. We really did. But I was able to appreciate in retrospect it even more, you know, when I look at what he accomplished for a very, very small budget, what he accomplished from, you know, stealing locations and having a vision and making a movie. Now I think it was quite the accomplishment. Whenever you find yourself in a situation like that with someone who has the talent that Rob has and also the dedication, love, and passion, when it all comes together, that just, you realize that just doesn't happen all the time. It just doesn't. A finished product, you know, that's all Rob DeVore.
You know, I've cast my share of, continued to cast my share of non-actors, and I respect directors from Herzog, Brisson, or whoever, who's worked with non-actors, you know, and it's incredible, and it's always so nerve-wracking to do it, you know, because especially if you're going to give them formal lines, you know, if you can let them be themselves and kind of work their way around things, maybe a little more silently, but, you know, the Williford script was very, Paul was very tense, you know, because the one thing that I did not really allow was improvisation on that, in terms of the lines, because Williford is just such a crack dialogue writer, you know, I just wanted to be pretty respectful of that.
Yeah, no, and you did such a good job adapting them, because so much of it crosses from stage to page and vice versa. It sounds like you had a pretty long range between when you first picked up the book and when you actually shot everything. Did you go and find other Williford books just to see what else this guy had written, or would you consider yourself a Williford fan, or is this kind of more of a one-off?
You know, I had read, my first Williford book was New Hope for the Dead. And that was, you know, a late Mosley book. And then I think I read The Woman Chaser, and then I, you know, started going through some of his late 50s and early 60s stuff. So, yeah, I love his essays and, you know, his poetry and stuff like, you know, and I love the fact that he taught detective writing. He understood the mechanics of it so well about crafting a plot. I love he just blows me away. I mean, you know, he was in Hollywood for a brief time, but man, to like know the mechanics of making a film the way he did, I mean, in that book, is just, it's mind blowing. You know, he's just such a smart guy and such an eye for details. It's and so funny.
What were some of your tougher decisions when it came to adapting the book to the screen?
I don't know what version you've seen, but the most shocking scene in the book, without question, is when his secretary, Laura, comes back into the studio one night and she's pregnant, and she insists on Richard marrying her, and, you know, Richard is there, obviously, to burn down the studio. It's at the end of the film, and, you know, she kind of pops into his radar. And he punches her in the stomach. And in the book, the language is like, you know, he punched her and, it, you know, his fist disappeared wrist deep into the soft folds of her belly. I mean, it was really graphic and really unsettling. It's like almost like, how could you write this? There was discussion about whether, you know, it was too... I mean, frankly, we premiered with the New York Film Festival with that scene. And then in Sundance, the producers had it taken out. And I don't think it would have had one way or the other influence the overall success of the film, but that was a particular scene that I think, you know, showed Williford committing to an attitude in his character, really writing it, you know, in a ghastly, kind of amazing way. You know, I was going to feel like a little bit of a, you know, pussy if I didn't at least try to do that. It just didn't really work out. It's not the easiest thing to film either, and it's blah, blah, blah. So, but we filmed it, and it's around, you know, it's around somewhere in a cut in somewhere that may show up one day.
We premiered at New York with 93 minutes. We went to Sundance and kept the punch, but cut down to 90 minutes at South by Southwest. Essentially 3 months later, we were 89 minutes, and we cut out the punch. And we went from being, you know, very controversial to winning the audience award at the festival at South by Southwest. The punch is essential to the story. It's Williford. We wanted to do it. You know, we, you know, wrung our hands over that decision. We had test screenings, although I would say we probably didn't have a large enough sample to really give it a fair airing. We chose that. And, you know, sometimes you're rewarded for that kind of thing, and sometimes you aren't. The original world premiere, 1999, New York, to essentially South by Southwest in March of 2000, we had three different cuts. And every time we had to spend money to change the negative, that was money that was essentially coming out of our music budget. That's one of the reasons that we were behind the eight ball on this. You know, those cuts represent essentially 3 minutes.
The score is so terrific. How much of the budget was the score?
It's the bane of our existence. You know, we are actively trying to essentially raise the money to take care of the music licenses. We had hoped that we could make a deal originally that would, you know, would pay for those, and since we didn't, it's just one of those things that we were never able to get out on DVD. On some level, you know, it was a freshman mistake that we were so needle drop dependent. Rob did such a great job, Rob and our music supervisor, of finding and placing all of those songs that, you know, at the end of the day, it was so far and above, you know, the music budget. Like I said, I mean, our hope was that we would make a deal and our distributor would be willing to, you know, come in and take care of that for us.
Because of, you know, just a total lack of money, they made a deal for a limited VHS release, which they barely scraped together, you know, just totally saved any money they could. You know, there's a lot of heavyweights on that soundtrack, and I think that the eventual plan has been planned for many years now. Is to either record an original soundtrack and just re-release it like that. It's a pretty big investment, you know, to go back and put more money into a film that, you know, that may or may not even make that back. That's kind of where it stands. I mean, it is definitely kind of fallen into obscurity, and yet at the same time, it seems to be getting some good press, you know, in the cult realm. So I'm pleased. I think people know about it. It's no open wound for me. I just, you know, I'm very proud of the work, and I love the people who are in it. And my job is to keep being a good filmmaker so that it definitely, you know, it will come out one day in its all its glory.
One of these days, the stars will align, and we will do a 13-year anniversary of the Woman Chaser DVD package with all kinds of shit in it. You know, there'll be the color version, there'll be the black and white version, there'll be the punch, and there'll be the non-punch.
Since Seinfeld, you can't really turn on the television or go to the movies without seeing you. Family Guy, Rules of Engagement, you're pitching for, what, is Honda, is it?
Yeah.
And then you've got the golf stuff that you do. I wanted to find out more about that.
Oh, well, I'm glad you're asking. This will be the second year of my golf tournament, which benefits St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. It's the first weekend of March in Palm Springs, and we've got a bunch of rock legends, you know, Robbie Krieger, and my buddy Jerry Cantrell said he's going to play, and I believe we got the Stephen Stills, and we've got the Don Felder. We have a great jam session on Friday night. And then Saturday night's a big comedy gala. You know, we got Spade did the comedy last year, trying to get him to do it again this year. We got 2 days of golf. It's incredibly affordable for one of these tournaments. It's a blast. And St. Jude said it was one of their best first-year events of all time. And so this year it's going to be even bigger. And so if anybody can come out, I mean, there's no better cause than St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. And everybody has a great time. So if anybody wants to go to it, just go to www.patrickwarburtongolf.com.
My favorite Williford story, I have to tell it. You'd appreciate it. I met his widow, Betsy Williford, a wonderful lady, and they were living in Miami, Florida together, you know, writing for the Miami Herald. She writes for the Miami Herald. I guess maybe he did occasionally, but he was just writing, you know, his books down there. And he moved in with Betsy, and Betsy had a daughter from another marriage, a 6-year-old or seven, eight-year-old. And they had an apartment right on the boardwalk. And they were out, hanging out outside, and it was time for dinner. And so they all went inside and sat at the table, Charles and Betsy and Betsy's daughter. And Charles said to the daughter, "You better go and get your doll." And the daughter said, "Why?" And Williford said, "It might get raped." So that's kind of Williford's humor.
Yeah, very dark humor.
All right, welcome back. Thank you so much, Paul, for sending me the review that you found of Woman Chaser. Hard Boiled as a 2-Day-Old Egg at a 2-Bit Diner by Stephen Holden, published May 8th, 1999. Like we were saying before, I just don't think that Holden knew what to make of this movie, and he kind of lashed out at it rather than understand where it was coming from. And, you know, too, I mean, if you don't have a background with Williford, I think you're going to think that this is 100% parody, that they took some old book and ripped it apart and poked fun at it, you know, kind of like taking Zero Hour and making it into Airplane or something.
Right. But
all the craziness is in the book.
The tone is exactly the same. It's not a parody of film noir. It's it is exactly what the book, the kind of weird sociopathic dark comedy thriller, I guess.
Right.
That the book projects.
So I went through and I highlighted some of the more choice phrases here. So yeah, he starts off by saying, maybe it's time for a moratorium on that most hackneyed of movie making concepts, the film noir spoof. The film noir parody tends to feel stale and rehashed. And again, it's like,
What?
Were there a lot of film noir spoofs at the time? I mean, there were a few here and there I can think of, but I don't think of it as a huge marketing concept that was sweeping through the nation.
It wasn't, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid or something.
Right.
And then it says that it strives desperately for a zaniness that is largely absent from the screenplay and from comic performances that are all too blank and unfocused to register as parody. It's not supposed to be zany, you know? I mean, if anything, it's dark. You know, I think that was your word. It's pretty darn dark.
Definitely. And it's a shame that one review like this can kind of really hurt the film's distribution as it did.
Right. I have problems with this review from the headline on down, actually.
Yeah.
Because I think it would be better if it said hard boiled as a 2 minute egg at a 2-bit diner. If you put an egg into boiling water for only 2 minutes, it's pretty darn soft. So
right.
I don't know. I think that would have been a little bit better, but we
need to review this review entirely.
Yes. Yeah, it's just a shame that kind of thing can put such a horrible spin on the film that it's still suffering from it today.
Mm-hmm.
I have gone through, and you know that if you know me at all, Paul, you know that I'm very OCD when it comes to things. And I've gone through this week and I made a list of all the songs that were in the film on the soundtrack. And I've tracked down every single song, I think, except for one. And so when we go ahead and post this podcast, I will post maybe a torrent file. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the best way is to do this, but I'm going to post somehow for folks to get the real soundtrack for the film if they ever want to do that. So all those songs are in there. It's a great, great collection of music. They did a terrific job.
It really is. And I one of the songs I recognize because it's on also on the Big Lebowski soundtrack, and I unfortunately don't remember which one it was. But
it's the Ima Sumac song.
Yes.
I think.
Yeah.
If I'm even pronouncing that correctly.
It works for me.
Okay, thanks. So I was actually lucky enough to see one of the early screenings of this film. I was in New York at the time of the New York Film Festival when this ran. According to Stephen Holden's review, I'm glad that you found this review because it reminds me exactly when I saw the film. He says that it is being shown at 6 p.m. and Saturday at 3 p.m. at Alice Tully Hall at part of the 37th New York Film Festival. So I don't remember seeing it in the evening. I must have seen the Saturday 3 p.m. screening. And I think that I kind of, maybe I exaggerated the length of my business trip to my boss so that I could stay an extra day or get in a little bit early in order to see The Woman Chaser, because it just happened that I was going to New York on business back before the internet bubble burst and was able to scam my way into. And then I managed to see The Woman Chaser. So it was wonderful. So I got to see the infamous stomach punch scene.
Right. I've read about that scene, but I have not seen it because I've only seen it off of VHS. So I've only seen it after they had cut that scene out in order to secure distribution.
You know, for me, it was just so natural that I can't say natural, but it was so part of the book that when it happened, it was just like so matter of fact for me. Like, oh, of course this happens. You know, we should set it up for folks listening at home is that after he sleeps with his secretary, he basically avoids her for a while, gets her kicked out of his office, calls up the studio, says, she's a great typist, but she can't work with me, and gets her taken away. And then eventually she comes back into the story to reveal that she's pregnant. And so let me go ahead. I'm going to read the passage from the book because I think that describes it a lot better. And then you get a little bit of sense of Hudson's voiceover here as well. I don't remember if there was voiceover in this part of the movie. Hmm. There probably was, but so she comes in, tells him that she's pregnant. If you don't want it, get rid of it, he says. That takes money, Richard, a great deal of money, and I don't know where to go, who to see. You've got to help me, Richard, she began to cry. All right.
The timing was terrible on Laura's part. At another time, another place, I would have handled the situation quite differently, given her a check, or I might have sent her to a doctor I know in Stockton. If she had wanted to keep the baby, I would have paid the bills, and maybe I would have set up a little monthly allowance for the child support. I don't know exactly how I would have handled it, but this way, she picked a bad time. As I straightened up, I brought my fist up hard. My fist caught Laura squarely in the soft part of her rounded belly and sank in wrist deep. Her breath whooshed audibly as it left her lungs. She bent over forward, almost falling, took two short backward steps, and then sat down hard upon the floor. I lifted her to the couch, straightened her legs. Laura clutched her stomach with both hands and slowly began to breathe again. Tears of pain and anger flowed down her swollen cheeks. "Breathing okay now?" I asked. Laura nodded her chin tremulously. "You'll be all right now, kid. That ought to do it for you. There'll be a couple of bad days, I suppose, but they can't be helped. The next time you get laid, you better use some kind of precautions, because I may not be around to help you."
That is just brutal. See, and that's why I'm kind of glad that I'd like to see the scene. I'd like to see the movie intact with that scene. But I'm kind of glad that my first viewing did not have that scene in it, because it would have, especially having not read the book, it would have kind of pushed it over the line of being just really cruel and mean-spirited, especially if it didn't have narration to it, where it's kind of justifying his mood and justifying, well, if it was any other situation, I would have actually taken care of it. But because I was in so pissed off, I'm just going to punch her in the belly. That would have just tipped it into either being so dark or so ridiculous that it becomes parody. Like I said, I'd like to see it with that scene, but at the same time, I'm glad that my first exposure to the movie didn't have that in it. Partially, it's because I can't visualize that scene, so maybe it's pulled off perfectly, but I have a hard time seeing that in the movie.
Yeah, that is the moment where all sympathy leaves for Richard Hudson,
you know,
and because he is, even though he is crazy and he is a sociopath, he is sympathetic throughout the entire film. Mm. But yeah, that is probably the moment that turns the audience against him. Didn't for me, because I knew who Richard Hudson was, and I was just like, okay. And then what follows it up, though, what's still in the movie, you know, is what it looks like in the movie version that you see now, that you've seen, that most people have seen, is him basically saying, "I can't handle this now. I can't deal with this now," you know, and before he punches her. And then him leaving, turning around and saying,
"Does the light bother you? The studio has a campaign, you know, save on electricity."
So he was leaving her in the dark after he just punched her in the stomach.
Right.
That, yeah, which even added more insult when you watch that original version. Just like, "I can't even be bothered to stay," you know, because in the book, at least he's like, "Do you want me to drive you home?" And she's like, "You know, don't even come near me," and all this kind of stuff. But no, he's just like, "Okay, there you go.
Turn the lights off. Turn the lights off on the way out." Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. So which makes the ending even more, and this is not a spoiler for anybody listening, it makes the ending even more pointed when he gets in that car at the end. And she's in the car, you know, because it's just like his past coming back to haunt him. And I love the images. I love the visual. You get it in your mind, of course, when you're reading the book. But when you actually see it on screen, you see those car salesmen in those Santa Claus suits, you know.
"With the phone, cool one, and call a costume company."
"Any company in particular?"
"One that sells Santa Claus suits, complete with beards."
"What sizes?"
"Sizes worn by Evans, Cartwell, and Jody Boy, our three-star salesmen."
"You shouldn't do it, Chief. It's the middle of August. Those guys will melt out there."
"It's the first day of August, and they'll wear those suits every damn day until I tell them to take them off." "What's more unusual than Santa Claus selling used cars in August?"
"You got me for the moment."
"Nothing."
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I had a friend, I described that scene to him, and he drew out what he thought it would look like of the cop coming and taking away Richard Hudson. And, you know, you see the beard is kind of falling off, and he's got this crazy look in his face, and he's got sunglasses on, and the cop's just trying to pull him into this car. And yeah, it's so good. I'll have to find that picture and post it up with this, because it's just awesome.
Well, and he's kind of jubilant as he gets into the car. He's, you know, saying, "God rusty, merry gentleman. And
yeah,
no, he's in a good frame of mind. His work here is done.
Exactly. No? Yeah, there's no repentance whatsoever. And that's probably another thing that turned Stephen Holden against him. Right. Yeah.
The sociopath does not see the error of his ways or get punished. Well, I mean, technically he gets punished, but not really in his mind. So
right. We never actually see the punishment happen. Right. I mean, we see him in the theater telling the story, but don't really know where that's at. That's just the theater of his mind, apparently. Mm. Yeah. Never get to see a trial. Right. I mean, because, yeah, he just brings down everyone. You know, there's no one that is untouched by him by the end of the story. The only guy who got away is the guy who he basically stole the used car lot from.
Can you talk briefly about The Man Who Got Away, the movie within the movie? I love the concept of this movie. I want to see this movie. You know, it's kind of like this vanishing point by way of a blast of silence sort of thing, where it's just grim and gritty and hateful and about the misery of mankind.
I know, I would love to see that movie, and I'd love to see it, especially after that guy was playing the electric guitar over it and stuff. Yeah, because I was just like, yeah, this is great. You know, that opening shot with the truck coming towards you, and you got that guitar wailing and the feedback going.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it reminded me a little of, what was the Humphrey Bogart movie? They Drive by Night or something?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I always used to get that and They Live by Night mixed up, which is not a good thing to do.
But it's like he creates this movie, which, you know, if this movie had actually been created, it would have taken on this mythical status by this point.
Oh, yeah.
It would have been this amazing lost discovery that people would be searching high and low for.
Never to be seen, though.
Right, exactly.
Not even the script exists anymore.
Right. That's the most brutal part for me. That was actually more brutal for me to read than the abortion scene. It's like, he's burning everything. All of these films are going to be destroyed.
I know. They're
going to be archived. Like, the film collector in me was just morally repulsed by it. So
yeah, and there are probably copies of the longer version of Magnificent Ambersons and
Midnight is right over there. Like
exactly, and Smokey is the Bandit.
Right, you know, that's where the Day the Clown Cried went. You know,
exactly. Yeah, he's so passionate about it too, and it does seem to be a great work of art. And that's kind of the real thing too, is that he makes this terrific work of art and really is passionate about it. But yeah, it's got to be on his terms.
Right.
Can't be any other way.
Well, yeah. you have to respect that in a weird, perverse, insane sort of way. So
I do. Even at 63 minutes, I didn't want to see the one that had been padded out with the chase scenes and all that.
Right. I wanted to see the one that would make people angry.
Exactly. Yeah, and I wanted to see, you know, all those reaction shots. And I love how they describe that and how he gets the reaction shots of people by having a stripper.
Mm-hmm.
And, just his the way that Hudson directs the film is just so entertaining. You know, like getting that performance out of the lead actress.
Right.
I'm intentionally leaving a lot of stuff vague for folks just so that they, have to go and check it out. But that's the real tragedy, too. Speaking of movies that you can't see, I mean, not only can we not see The Man Who Got Away, but there's a lot of folks who are not going to be able to see this movie. Personally, I would like it if every movie that I talked about on the show was very readily available. But sometimes you just got to talk about movies that you love, even if they're not out there for the world to see. Mm-hmm. But hopefully this will either inspire folks to find it. I can't wait. I hope that a DVD of this thing comes out.
Especially with the alternate, the color version.
Yeah.
Which I'd really be curious to see. I mean, I have a hard time picturing it in color, but I'd be curious to see what that looks like. I mean, I held off on Forbidden Zone for such a long time of watching the color version because, to me, Forbidden Zone is in black and white.
Right.
But then I finally watched the color version. It's like, this is actually really neat because Richard Elfman did a lot of effort into actually making this the color version that he wanted to make.
And yeah, there's care in it. It's not like watching those horrible TNT kind of things where they just kind of like, we'll spot color this here and this there. And, you know, somebody ends up having green
green skin in a scene.
Right, yeah.
I went out after talking to Joe McSpadden, and I looked for some of the stills out online anyway of the color version, and the color does look pretty nice. It looks very, very muted. It's almost like a watercolor, you know, so it's not these bright primary colors that would just be, you know, garish and hurting the eye or anything. All right, so let's go ahead. We're going to take a break and play a clip from next week's show.
This man has $6 million worth of heroin. It belongs to the mob, and all it will cost him is his life. American International Pictures presents The Italian Connection. The Italian Connection, the story of an international manhunt. With a cast of international stars, Luciana Paluzzi, Cyril Cusack, and Henry Silva and Woody Strode as the hunters.
I want you to kill him in the most brutal way possible, because I want it to be conspicuous, sensational. In other words, make it obvious that the job was commissioned by the New York bosses.
They've come 5,000 miles to stalk their prey. Now, they're moving in for the kill. Godfather signs your death warrant. There's no place in the world you can hide.
Hurry! Shoot him!
The Italian Connection. Make it, you'll make a fortune. Miss it, you'll get a little round hole right between your eyes.
And we're back. That was a preview for next week's show, all about The Italian Connection. I'll be joined in the projection booth by Eurocrime documentary director and all-around nice guy Mike Malloy. I want to thank this week's guest, Paul Freitag. So, Paul, tell me a little bit more about the Psychotronic Netflix group.
Well, the Psychotronic Netflix group, I just started because I noticed that there were a lot of new and interesting streaming titles coming to Netflix that weren't really available on DVD and that had been invisible for so long. And I kind of wanted a way to let people know that these new and cool titles were now available on streaming when you couldn't really get them anywhere else. So I started this group and just kind of posted links to Netflix streaming titles. And it's kind of evolved a little bit since then, where I'm not really just posting titles that are out of print or hard to find, where I'm just posting kind of new and interesting streaming titles. And it's basically based off of whatever happens to me new and catches my interest that I think other people are going to be interested in. There's not really a lot of rhyme and reason to it. So it's just based on my own personal whims, which is kind of the way I like it. But if you just go on Facebook and search for Psychotronic Netflix, you can add us on.
Or you can get all crazy and go to, what is it, facebook.com/pages/psychotronic-netflix.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, hopefully folks understand how to spell psychotronic, because otherwise just can't help you out there.
Right. Listen to this podcast. Come on.
Right, exactly. But yeah, I love having it. I love having those things come up, and because it's very surprising. I try to keep up on Netflix as much as I can. You know, I go to, I think it's like instantwatch.com or something, and they list
four different like Netflix accumulator sites that I go to check it out so I can like find things as soon as they're available. Like this morning, Walker, the Alex Cox movie, just showed up on streaming. So there's lots of neat stuff coming up regularly, and I try to stay out of all of the Netflix hype and news and all of the drama that Netflix has been inflicting on itself over the last few months. But.
I know. They're like the drama queen girl at high school. Where you're just like, oh gosh, really?
Yeah.
I've got another stalker. Yeah.
Oh, like gosh. You seem nice, but you're just doing this to yourself.
Yeah. You might not want to date her. So. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But you're not going to date her ugly sister Blockbuster, that's for sure.
No kidding.
Yeah. Let's make sure that folks get out there and go to the Psychotronic Netflix group. Again, best way to do it is just go to Facebook, type in Psychotronic Netflix, and you'll get good updates. Put them on your feed or whatever. Subscribe, whatever Facebook is doing this week. And so then you can see all the good stuff that's coming out.
Yeah, hopefully maybe someday the Woman Chaser will just show up randomly one morning as...
Right.
As, you know, it seems very random. It doesn't seem to be really have to do with who legally owns what at some times, because there's been things on Netflix that I thought were completely tied up in legal binding. So,
all right. So I want to thank folks for listening. Be sure to check out more episodes of The Projection Booth on iTunes via Stitcher. You can get that in the iTunes or Android App Store, or you can listen to us on Jackalope Radio, or you can get the scoop over at the Projection Booth website at projection-booth.com. Make sure you stop by the website this week so you can download that compilation of the Woman Chaser unofficial soundtrack. So thanks again, Paul, and we'll be talking to you again soon, I hope.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for letting me talk about the movie.
Number one, you can kiss me, but not too wet. I don't like it. Two, you can fondle my breasts, but that's it. When you're ready, just tell me, and I'll relieve you.
You what?
I'll relieve you. You know what I mean? I'm a virgin, Richard, whether you believe it or not, and I intend to stay that way.
So you're one of those fellatio experts.
What's that?
Good night, Laura.
Don't you want to kiss me good night?
Thanks. I kissed too wetly.